Imagine, you've just been rear-ended by an 80,000-pound semi-truck on a really narrow, winding parkway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you manage to, pull yourself out of your car. Your heart is just pounding out of your chest, but you check your arms, your legs, and you actually feel completely fine.
Right? Adrenaline is a crazy thing.
Exactly. You tell the paramedics you're okay, but medically speaking, your body is lying to you just to ensure your immediate survival.
Yeah, it's a survival mechanism.
Right. And legally, a ticking clock has just started that could, well, completely erase your ability to prove the accident wasn't your fault.
It is a terrifying paradox, honestly. I mean, the moments immediately following a massive commercial collision are precisely when victims are least equipped to handle all the cascading medical and legal consequences that are headed their way.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are taking a really close look at an eye-opening legal article provided by you, our listener. This piece was actually published by the law offices of Norman Gershon, and it dissects a recent overnight tractor-trailer crash on the Hutchinson River Parkway.
Right, the one near the Mamaroneck Road Bridge.
Yeah, exactly, right at exit 12 in Scarsdale.
Yeah. And the focus of this material isn't just about, one bad night of traffic. It's really an autopsy of a systemic breakdown. It explores this dangerous clash between vintage civil engineering and modern commercial logistics.
Oh, for sure.
And of course, the incredibly complex corporate battleground that victims just step into the second that metal crumples.
Okay, let's unpack this from the ground up. Our mission today is to figure out why this specific Westchester County commuter route acts like a giant truck trap.
A literal trap.
Yes, literally. We are going to explore the devastating ripple effects of these massive accidents, both physically and logistically, and then we're going to untangle the web of liability that follows. So let's start with the geography.
Good place to start.
The source establishes a core conflict right away, which is that the Hutchinson River Parkway was fundamentally never designed for commercial freight. Like, at all.
Not even a little bit.
It's infamous for low-clearance bridges, very narrow lanes, tight curves, and these impossibly short merge lanes.
Right, and to really understand the hazard, you have to look at the engineering intent.
Yeah.
I mean, when roads like the Hutch were conceived back in the 1920s and 30s, they were quite literally built as scenic parkways for Sunday drives.
Oh, like for early passenger cars.
Exactly. Just look at the overpasses. They're often these really beautiful stone arch bridges. But an arch means the clearance height is drastically lower on the right and left lanes than it is dead center.
Oh, right, because it curves down.
Yeah. And a modern commercial trailer is 13 feet 6 inches tall, and it's perfectly rectangular.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the geometry just simply rejects the vehicle.
Which brings up a glaring contradiction in the text, actually. The author points out that there are numerous highly visible warning signs on the approaches to the parkway, strictly prohibiting commercial traffic.
Right, they are everywhere.
Some even have like flashing lights and hanging chains that the trucks physically hit to warn them. I really struggle to understand this. We are talking about professional drivers holding commercial driver's licenses.
Yeah.
How on earth does a supposedly trained driver miss giant flashing signs? It's like trying to thread a massive 80,000-pound needle at 60 miles per hour, completely blindfolded.
What's fascinating here is that it sounds absurd on the surface, but the source text outlines this crazy cocktail of compounding human and systemic errors.
Okay, so it's not just one thing.
Right. It's rarely just one bad driver.
Yeah.
Yes, driver inexperience, severe fatigue, and distracted driving, they play massive roles. But the most insidious factor mentioned here is blind reliance on standard GPS navigation.
Wait, real?
Yeah, coupled with improper routing dictated by the trucking companies themselves.
Hold on, wait. You're telling me that a billion-dollar commercial logistics company is dispatching an 80,000-pound rig using standard consumer GPS apps, like the same ones on my phone?
Sometimes, yeah.
Don't they have enterprise routing software that specifically flags low bridges?
I mean, they absolutely should. Commercial-grade GPS platforms allow you to input the exact height, weight, and, hazardous material status of your vehicle, and they route you accordingly.
Right.
But that software costs money. So many smaller carriers or independent owner-operators working under intense financial pressure, they just fire up standard smartphone navigation.
Oh, wow.
And those consumer apps simply calculate the shortest distance between point A and point B. They have absolutely no idea you are driving a 70-foot rectangular box.
And I imagine the dispatchers are pushing these drivers to like shave minutes off their delivery times, right?
Exactly. Time is money.
So if the algorithm says taking the Hutch saves 20 minutes, The fatigued driver just follows the little blue line, completely tuning out the physical environment.
Right up until they hear the sound of their trailer roof being peeled off like a tin can by a stone bridge.
Ugh, that visual is just terrifying.
It's the phenomena of cognitive offloading. The driver trusts the glowing screen way more than their own eyes. And when that inevitable strike happens, like this 11 p.m. crash in Scarsdale, the consequences don't just stay isolated to that one bridge.
Yeah, let's look at the ripple effect. Because knowing why these trucks end up in the trap kind of explains the sheer chaos that follows.
Oh, total chaos.
The source describes a massive interconnected web of local roads that suffer the very moment the Hutchinson River Parkway goes down. We're talking about commuters traveling between Scarsdale, White Plains, New Rochelle, down through Yonkers and the Bronx.
Yeah, that entire corridor.
When the Hutch is blocked, that pressure violently shifts to other roads.
You can think of Westchester's highway system almost like a fluid dynamics problem. You have massive volume flowing through very specific arterial channels.
Okay, yeah.
If you suddenly dam up one of those primary channels, well, the kinetic energy and the volume, they just have to go somewhere else immediately.
The text lists the overflow landing on I-287, the Cross County, Bronx River, Sawmill River, Major Deegan, and the Cross Bronx Expressways. So what does this all mean for the average commuter traveling between Westchester and NYC? Like, even at 11 p.m., is a road closure really that catastrophic?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It creates a highly volatile secondary hazard zone. It is rarely just a long, frustrating wait in your car.
Right.
Look at the mechanics of the parkway we just described. You've got tight, winding, blind curves. If a truck strikes a bridge at high speed, it stops instantly. Massive debris rains down.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and the traffic behind it comes to a sudden dead stop. The motorists coming around that blind curve behind them, they have zero visibility and virtually zero reaction time.
So they just slam right into the back of the jam.
Exactly. The source points out that this exact scenario creates a severe immediate risk of high-speed secondary pileups.
Which transitions us from the macro level of, you know, traffic gridlock straight into the micro level, the catastrophic physical impact. Because when an 80,000-pound machine hits passenger vehicles or causes a multi-car pileup, the human toll is just devastating.
Devastating is the right word.
Yeah, the source doesn't sugarcoat the grim reality of the injuries at all.
Well, they can't. The physics of a collision involving commercial freight are entirely asymmetrical. A standard passenger car weighs, what, maybe 4,000 pounds?
Something like that, yeah.
It is simply not designed to absorb or deflect the kinetic energy transferred by an object 20 times its size. The crumple zones just fail, and that violent force is transferred directly into the fragile biomechanics of the human occupants.
The article lists traumatic brain injuries, neck and back trauma, herniated spinal discs, internal organ damage, spinal cord injuries, broken bones, and even permanent disability.
Yeah, it's brutal.
I mean, a herniated disc from this kind of impact isn't just a sore back. It is the gelatinous core of your spine being violently squeezed out under thousands of pounds of pressure, pressing directly against your nerves.
It's excruciating.
But here's where it gets really interesting, and it ties back to that scenario I mentioned at the very top of the show.
Right, the delayed symptoms.
Exactly. The text highlights that victims often walk away from the wreckage thinking they've escaped unharmed, only to experience severe neurological symptoms days later. I mean, how is the body even capable of suppressing that level of damage?
It really comes down to evolutionary biology. When you are involved in a massive, terrifying event, you know, metal crushing, glass shattering, the smell of smoke, your brain registers a mortal threat.
It thinks you're about to die.
Exactly. Yeah. So it immediately triggers a fight or flight response, flooding your endocrine system with adrenaline, cortisol, and endorphins. This biochemical cocktail is designed to keep you moving so you can escape the immediate danger.
Wow.
Yeah. It acts as an incredibly powerful systemic painkiller.
So your body is essentially overriding the pain signals just so you can physically pull yourself out of a burning car.
That's exactly it. You might have a fractured vertebra, a torn ligament, or even a slow internal bleed in your abdomen. But your brain suppresses those pain signals.
That is wild.
The real danger, though, is that this biochemical flood is temporary. It takes anywhere from 24 to 48 hours for those hormones to fully recede. And as they do, massive inflammation sets in, Fluid builds up in the damaged tissues, and that is when the excruciating pain or numbness finally hits you.
Oh, that delayed onset makes total sense now, and it completely explains why the source is absolutely adamant that victims must seek medical attention immediately, even if they feel, quote-unquote, fine at the scene.
Yes, absolutely critical.
Because if you wait a week to go to the doctor, I imagine the insurance companies will just use that delay against you, right?
Oh, they absolutely will, without a doubt. If there's a gap in treatment, a corporate defense lawyer will argue that your injuries didn't happen in the crash. They'll say, you know, that you hurt your back lifting a heavy box in your garage three days later.
Wow, they really do that.
Every time. Seeking immediate medical evaluation establishes an unbreakable causal link between the impact and your injuries.
Which brings us directly to the legal battlefield. Figuring out who pays for this devastation is where things get incredibly complicated.
Very complicated.
The text notes that unlike a simple fender bender, a commercial crash involves a massive cast of characters. If two passenger cars hit each other, it's just driver A's insurance versus driver B's insurance.
Right. Pretty straightforward.
But here, I mean, we're talking about the blame pie. The liability could fall on the truck driver, the trucking company, the maintenance contractors, the cargo loaders, or even the equipment manufacturers.
Yeah, the industry is intentionally structured this way. It is designed from the ground up to diffuse liability.
I think of it less like a standard lawsuit and more like a really high-stakes game of hot potato. Or like a Russian nesting doll of shell companies.
That's a great way to put it.
You open up the first layer, the driver. But wait, the driver doesn't own the truck, so you open the next layer, the logistics company. But they lease the trailer from a third party. And the maintenance, oh, that was outsourced to a fourth party.
Yep, and every single layer has its own corporate legal team and insurance adjusters all frantically trying to point the finger at the other dolls to avoid paying out.
It's exhausting just thinking about it.
It is. If we connect this to the bigger picture, winning that complex game of finger pointing relies entirely on one thing: who controls the data. In a modern commercial truck, there is an enormous amount of telemetry and video data being constantly recorded.
But the text warns us that this evidence is incredibly fragile.
Extremely fragile.
Let's look at the ticking clock the source mentions. They list electronic logging device data, maintenance records, driver qualification files, GPS info, dash cams, and surveillance video. How does this evidence just vanish if a lawyer doesn't step in immediately? Like, are these companies actively destroying evidence?
Well, they don't even have to maliciously destroy it. They just let the system override it through standard retention protocols. Take the electronic logging device, or the ELD, for example.
Okay.
This piece of hardware is plugged directly into the engine. It records whether the driver was legally exhausted by tracking engine hours, speed, hard braking events, and RPMs. But federal regulations only require companies to keep those logs for 6 months.
Oh, wow. So if you don't file a specific legal demand within that window, they just hit delete and say, sorry, standard company policy.
Precisely. And the same applies to dash cams. Most commercial dash cams record on a continuous loop.
Yeah.
Once the memory card is full, it just writes right over the oldest footage. Yeah. So if an attorney doesn't immediately send what's called a spoliation letter, which is a formal legal mandate demanding the preservation of that specific data, the video showing the driver looking down at their phone while ignoring the low bridge warning signs will literally erase itself in a matter of days.
That is genuinely terrifying. The evidence that proves your innocence is practically programmed to self-destruct.
It really is.
So, armed with the understanding of how complex and time-sensitive these investigations are, the source pivots in its final section to a very specific checklist for victims and a really strong pitch for who should represent them. Let's run through their immediate action plan for anyone involved in a truck accident on these local parkways.
Yeah, the first steps are all about securing the scene and, obviously, your health.
Call 911 immediately. Seek medical treatment, even if you feel okay, for the biological reasons we discussed. Take photos of the vehicles, the roadway, the debris field, and definitely get witness information.
All crucial.
But then the source drops a critical warning. Do not give recorded statements to insurance adjusters before consulting a lawyer. Why are they so adamant about avoiding just a simple phone call with an adjuster?
Because the adjuster calling you is a highly trained corporate risk manager. Their sole objective is to minimize their company's financial exposure. They will call you when you are lying in a hospital bed, likely heavily medicated and disoriented.
Oh, that's just predatory.
It is. They will ask friendly leading questions like, hey, how are you feeling today? If you say, I guess I'm doing a little better. Well, They now have a recorded statement of you downplaying your injuries before the full extent of the neurological damage has even been diagnosed.
Wow, so they are essentially setting verbal traps, which explains why the article transitions right into detailing the specific profile of its author, the Law Offices of Norman Gershon. The text makes a really clear argument that you need specialized representation to deal with these specific tactics. They highlight the firm's 35 years of experience across the New York metro area from Westchester all the way to Manhattan.
Right.
But the phrase that stands out most is their reputation as the attorney other lawyers call to try their toughest cases. What does that actually signal to someone reading this?
It signals a very critical distinction in the personal injury field. A vast majority of injury lawyers are what the industry calls settlement lawyers.
Okay, meaning what?
Meaning they process paperwork, they negotiate with adjusters, and they generally take whatever the insurance company eventually offers because they have no real intention of actually going to court. Taking a massive logistics conglomerate to a jury trial requires massive outlay of capital.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, you need expert witnesses, accident reconstructionists, and intense specialized litigation skills.
So when other lawyers hit a wall with a stubborn corporate defendant, they hand the file over to a heavy hitter who isn't afraid of the courtroom. And honestly, the source provides a list of staggeringly high verdicts to back up this trial reputation.
Oh, the numbers are huge.
Yeah. They list a $16.5 million verdict for a bus collision passenger, a $14.5 million settlement for a catastrophic bus accident, over $5 million for a motor vehicle verdict, and millions more for sideswipes and spinal injuries. By the way, the source stresses that if anyone finds themselves in this nightmare, they should only use the phone number 914-485-4444 to reach Norman Gershon's office. He only gets paid if you win, and apparently insurance companies actually know and fear him.
And when you look at verdict numbers that high, it's really crucial to understand what they actually represent. To the average person, $16.5 million sounds like a lottery jackpot.
Right. It sounds like you're set for life.
But in a courtroom, that number is a meticulously calculated reflection of utter devastation.
It's not a prize. It's a life care plan.
Exactly. When a jury awards a sum like that, they are looking at the math of human destruction. They are factoring in 24-hour specialized nursing care for the rest of the victim's life.
Wow.
They are calculating the cost of future repeated spinal fusion surgeries. They are replacing decades of lost earning capacity for someone who will literally never be able to work again alongside the profound permanent loss of their quality of life.
Yeah.
The size of the verdict is a direct mirror of the catastrophic physics we discussed earlier.
When an 80,000-pound truck crushes a passenger vehicle.
Yes, exactly.
That completely reframes how I look at those numbers. It really does. And the text wraps up this argument with client testimonials praising the firm's thorough preparation, his courtroom demeanor, and their ability to secure larger than expected results. I mean, the entire article basically operates as a comprehensive argument.
It does.
It establishes the terrifying infrastructural realities of Westchester's parkways, explains the medical and legal minefields victims face, and then positions their decades of specialized trial experience as the necessary shield against the corporate logistics machine.
It paints a very stark picture of the David versus Goliath dynamic inherent in commercial truck litigation.
So let's recap the journey we've taken you on today. We started by exploring the architectural dangers of vintage Northeast infrastructure, specifically how the 1920s stone arches of the Hutchinson River Parkway physically reject the dimensions of modern commercial trailers.
And we examined the fluid dynamics of local traffic, right? And how a single bridge strike near Scarsdale immediately paralyzes the entire arterial network of Westchester and the Bronx, creating grave risks for secondary high-speed collisions.
Yeah. We also dove into the human body's fight or flight response, explaining how adrenaline masks catastrophic spinal and neurological trauma.
Right, which makes immediate medical evaluation a biological and a legal necessity.
Exactly. And finally, we unpacked the Russian nesting doll of corporate liability. We looked at how crucial digital evidence like ELD data and dash cam footage is just programmed to overwrite itself.
The vanishing evidence.
Yep. Highlighting exactly why victims face a ticking clock and require specialized trial attorneys to issue immediate legal holds. It is a massive amount of information to process, especially if you commute on these local parkways every single day.
It is a lot, yeah.
But looking at the root causes we discussed earlier leaves me with a lingering, honestly, slightly maddening thought. We talked extensively about how these truck traps are triggered by dispatchers and drivers blindly relying on algorithmic efficiency.
Right, using standard consumer GPS apps to shave a few minutes off a delivery while completely ignoring the physical reality of the road. This raises an important question that the legal framework is honestly only just beginning to grapple with. Right now, the liability rests heavily on the tired driver behind the wheel, the logistics company that hired them, and the contractors who maintain the fleet.
Well, what about the technology driving the truck into the trap?
Well, that is the new frontier of this legal battle. If a Silicon Valley software company writes a routing algorithm that continually directs 80,000-pound commercial trucks onto vintage parkways with low-clearance bridges, despite having access to the public data detailing those exact height restrictions, at what point does their legal liability begin?
Imagine adding a tech giant to that Russian nesting doll of corporate finger-pointing.
It would be huge.
But logically, it makes perfect sense. I mean, we are allowing modern, cutting-edge software to blindly dictate the movement of massive, deadly freight on infrastructure built for Sunday drives in the 1930s. And until the law forces the algorithms to respect the physical limits of our bridges, it seems the stone arches on the hutch are just going to keep taking hits.
And the surrounding commuters are going to keep paying the price.
Yep, unfortunately so. Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.